This is Saturday with Clare Byrne. We welcome your views on any of the topics on today's programme. You can get in touch by texting 51551, email saturday@rte.ie, and the Twitter address is @SaturdayRTE. First today, the Fine Gael Ordesh is underway at the RDS in Dublin, and from there we're joined by the Minister for Health, James Reilly. Minister, you're very welcome. Thank you for taking the time to join us today.
Thank you, Clare.
Can we start, first of all, with the report yesterday into maternity services in Portlaoise? I know you held a press conference and people have heard from you. But in the papers today, there's some speculation about whether budget cutbacks might have had an impact here. And I'm interested to get your view, because the INMO says 33 extra midwives are needed there, and three managers dealing with risk management weren't replaced. They left in 2010, and of course they weren't replaced because of the moratorium. What have you got to say to that speculation?
Well, look, the terrible tragedies that occurred down there, the first thing that has to be said is that, you know, had reports been acted on earlier, there's every chance that lives would have been saved. And I want to put on my record again my gratitude to the parents who've shown great tenacity and commitment to having this story told. And I really genuinely believe that this will now be a watershed moment for the health services, that things will change. In relation to your specific question, there's absolutely no doubt that we need to do an urgent review right across our maternity services in relation to the manpower issue, to see where we are short and deficient in staff and to address that.
Okay,
But I have to point out the following, Clare, if I may. Mm-hmm. It's critically important to point out that some of these tragedies occurred when the ward was not busy by any stretch of the imagination, and staffing levels could not possibly have been an explanation for what happened. I'm not saying that in other instances perhaps there might have been some contributing factors there, and it's certainly something that the HICWA report will go into in a much bigger way.
Okay.
But in the interim, the HSE will do an urgent review across the maternity services.
So you bring me then to my next question, because you said very clearly yesterday that Portlaoise needs to be fixed and will be fixed. But I'm wondering, is that the best way to go? Because if it wasn't busy there, as you say, and proper services couldn't be provided, is there not a very strong argument for centralisation of services? Some of these smaller hospital units should perhaps be closed.
Well, I don't want to mislead your visitors, your listeners at all, because I'm saying in some instances staffing levels couldn't possibly explain it, and yet we do know from this report that the number of births doubled in Portlaoise over a short few period of years, and they didn't get the concomitant support they should have got from the HSE. So I'm not ignoring that fact for one minute, but I want to come back to your central point. I said last night here at the Ordesh that in the past we have seen hospitals that have been undermined through lack of funding, then reports commissioned to show they're unsafe, and then those reports used to close the service. I'm not prepared to let this happen here.
Would that not be a safer option, though, Minister, in this instance?
Absolutely not. My view is very clear. The parents all made it very clear to me that they want this service fixed and they want it made safe. And that's my view too. I want this hospital to be supported, and that's why I'm very pleased that the HSE have acted with immediate effect to bring in a transitional team in order to ensure an orderly situation where support from the Coombe can come in. This is all part of the hospital groups that we've put in place, so it won't just happen here in Portlaoise. I want all our maternity services to be supported by their main maternity providers. I want to be able to spread the expertise from the centre to the periphery. I want to see doctors being prepared to come and work in the Coombe service, which means they'll also work in Portlaoise and elsewhere, and right across not just maternity but in surgery and in medicine as well. And that secures the future of the smaller hospitals. It secures that they will be safe. It means that we would have in place uniform protocols for the care of pregnant women and others. And can I say the final thing that I will on this? Part of this report too, there is a recommendation that HICWA will bring in a national monitoring situation, such as they do for hand hygiene, so that we can spot when things are going wrong, rather than waiting for parents to have to stand up and fight, as these parents have done with tremendous courage and commitment, and rather than waiting for a hospital to put its hand up. We need to have a system where, if you like, the fire alarm goes off and we can see there's possibly really a problem. We might go down and find there is none, but at least we can see that there are trends developing which could be problematic and we can take action. Be proactive instead of what we've been to date, reactive.
Well, would you accept, though, in some measure, that this is the financial crisis coming home to roost, that in part this may have been caused by budget cuts, which many will accept were unavoidable in certain circumstances, but because we were in that position where funding was not available to replace certain people who left, mistakes were made?
No, I don't accept that, and I say that for the following reason. Last night I made the point that between the year 1997 and 2009, the budget for health quadrupled. It went from 3.6 billion to 15 billion. Now, these instances go back to 2009 and before, so you can't explain it with that. What is required here, as I said last night, is reform. We have to change the way we're delivering care. We have to have better monitoring in place. We have to have much clearer understanding about responsibilities, lines of accountability, lines of communication.
Okay, Minister.
And if we go back to the tragedy of Savita Halappanavar in Galway, where the recommendations there have been put in place around having protocols around handover. In the past, we had a situation where, you know, the doctors came in, the nurses came in, they said hello, they got a couple of minutes together to exchange information, they were gone. That's dangerous. We need professionals to have time to ensure that the team coming on are fully informed of what's gone on through the night by the team that are leaving.
Okay, Minister, we're going to move on because I know we've limited time with you, and I want to apologise at this stage to our listeners. The background noise in the RDS is at quite a high level, but there's not very much we can do about that. We will plough on and move to universal health insurance. It's been front page news over the past couple of weeks. Now, Minister, we haven't seen the white paper yet. When are you going to publish it?
In the coming weeks. Obviously the Cabinet have to see it, but the Health Committee of Cabinet have passed it on to go to Cabinet, so there's a little bit of tweaking to be done, and I would expect that we will see it in the coming weeks. I think it's a hugely transforming part of the programme for government to change our health service, to bring a health service that's based on equity, where all citizens are treated on the basis of medical need and not what they can afford.
Okay, but there are a number of problems with it. The Department of Public Expenditure said that it represents a risk to the state's financial stability. What's your response?
Well, I can't see how you could possibly say that when we haven't...
They did say it.
Well, I don't see how you can say it, and I stand over that. Because we don't have to hand, you know, the full debate around what is it going to be in the basket of services. We don't even know what the taxation system would be by 2019. So what we need now, I believe, is the full consultation with the Irish people. I want to make something very clear here that I feel very strongly about. I believe it's our health service, and I believe all of us should be involved in designing the new health service. And that's why I want a broad discussion involving all of our people, having everybody have an opportunity into this. There will be a commission as well involved in determining the basket to a certain extent and bringing that to government. But government will have the final decision. And I'm very prepared to have in place and have suggested that there needs to be budget caps and cost control put in here. And if I could just say this, and I think it's critically important to say it, private health insurance in this country has become unaffordable because nobody has tackled the underlying costs. We're paying for procedures now that used to take 2 hours at the same rate, when now they only take 20 minutes with modern technology. Nobody's ever done a benchmark study on what a consultant should earn, define what an income should be, how long does a procedure take, base your payments on that. And also looking at clinical audits, something that's never been done, to my astonishment, by the VHI or other insurers. And that's to challenge doctors as to why they have done tests that have been done.
We were talking about universal health insurance on the programme last week. We told listeners in advance of your interview today that you would be talking about universal health insurance. And what most people are saying to us is, how much is this going to cost me as an individual? Now, are you saying that you haven't worked that out yet?
Well, let me say the following, which might help people. Firstly, those who are currently on medical cards, about 40% of people, are going to be fully subsidised by the government. The next 20-30% will be very heavily subsidised, and then those at the very top will be as they are. And don't forget, those at the very top are currently getting a subsidy through the tax system. Now, obviously, what we're saying in the paper is it doesn't make sense to have two modes of subsidy, and that we'll have one fund, but people will still get the subsidies they were getting. I believe personally that this two-tier system, which is both unfair, unethical, is also grossly inefficient. And we're actually spending more on health in this country than any other OECD country when you look at our age profile. We have a much younger population. So I don't see any reason why a single-tier, efficient, universal health insurance system should cost any more, and I don't believe it will cost any more than the current inefficient system.
But people feel they're already paying for their health service. That's the problem, isn't it, through their taxation?
They are, and therefore you'll ask, well, what more will we get? Well, you'll have a free GP care service with many more services locally, which they don't have at the moment. They will have a functioning hospital, because no matter what plan you have, Plan E or whatever it is, when you're acutely ill, it's a public emergency department you're going to end up in, and you want one that functions. So what we're doing is we're working right across the system in the private health insurance, in the HSE, in the Department of Health to reform all these areas, putting in place the building blocks like the money follows the patient system, bringing down waiting lists, bringing down the number of people on trolleys, bringing down the outpatients list. We want to have it all fixed so that when we do start universal health insurance, we have a working, efficient, fair system that everybody in this country can feel safe in when they've been treated, and that everybody who works in it can feel proud of, not just some of the time, but all the time.
You said a moment ago that those who have medical cards will be fully subsidised. Are you saying then that those reports we saw over the last couple of weeks, whereby it was speculated that those on welfare would have money stopped from their weekly payments in order to pay for a basic health insurance plan, that that's not the case?
Obviously not, because they're entitled to a medical card, so they're fully subsidised. What we're alluding to is the small percentage of individuals who can't afford to pay, who choose not to. They have this problem in other countries like the Netherlands and in Germany, and they have their ways of extracting the money if people aren't prepared to pay. So, I mean, I think, you know, this is our health service. I want everyone to join in this discussion. I'm sure we'll learn an awful lot more during the course of that. I think it would be wrong of us to have a closed mind on where this should go ultimately. I want the Irish people to feel part of this, to have ownership of this, and I want us to be as proud of this as other countries are of their health service. And can I finish by saying this in relation to this whole thing about the Dutch? We certainly looked at the Dutch system, we're very intrigued by that, but the more we've been looking and examining this, we're leaning towards the German way of controlling prices, and we're very fortunate in having contacts in Germany and some of the very senior people there who are very experienced in that, offering to come over to help us in relation to the National Pricing Office, which is already set up on an administrative basis.
Okay, now on that, I mean, you mentioned the Pricing Office. It was speculated during the week that 7 new quangos would be needed to run this universal healthcare system. Is that the case?
Not at all. Again, you see, look, people can interpret things whatever way they want.
Is that the Department of Public Expenditure spinning against you again, do you think?
Look, you know, there's always a natural tension between a large spending department like health and the department that has to control expenditure, like the Department of Public Expenditure and Reform. So the reality here is we're going to reduce 49 hospitals down to a group of 7, including the National Paediatric Hospital. So that's not increasing quangos, that's reducing administrative blocks. We're going to reduce the number of ISAs, as they're called, that's the integrated service areas, from 17 down to 9. So that's more reduction in terms of service units. So far from it being a quango generating initiative, this, it's quite the reverse. So, and, you know, when we come to the Patient Safety Agency, which is something I feel really strongly about, and obviously the events in Portlaoise kind of make it even more urgent that this is set up, and I'm very pleased, having talked to the Director General, that the post of CEO for that agency will be advertised this month. That's been set up on an administrative basis too, but will be put on a statutory basis later on when the legislation comes through.
Minister, how far are you going to get with this particular plan? Because we know there's a reshuffle on the way. Obviously, it's not going to be done in the lifetime of this government. So how important is it? How far do you want to get with this?
I want to get this to a point where we've all the building blocks in place.
Publication of the white paper, would that satisfy you in terms of what you have done to push this forward?
Oh, no, not at all. I mean, publication of the white paper will come in the next couple of weeks, and I want to see before the end of the following year that we have put in place some of the legislation that provides for universal health insurance into the future. So we're not resting on our laurels. I'm more determined, more energised, more committed than ever to this, because this is why I went into politics, to give Ireland a fair, equitable health service, something that a modern, real republic would want for all its citizens, that all its citizens can avail of, and that nobody feels excluded from.
It would be disappointing then, from what you're saying, for you to be shuffled out of health and onto somewhere else.
Well, yes, obviously people would know what my preference is, but I mean, the Taoiseach is a man who will make decisions based on what he feels is best for the country and best meets the needs of the country, and I will always respect that, and he has my full support regardless of the decision he makes.
Okay, all eyes there, I'd imagine, today on the midterm test. That is the local and European elections. Not often that a government party can hold its own in a midterm. Do you think Labour will take the flak or are Fine Gael on the firing line as well?
Look, I think it's always difficult, as you've pointed out, for governments midterm. We've had to make a lot of hard decisions, some of which were not popular. We know that people asked us to do a job. They never said they'd like the way we do it. They never said they'd like us for doing it. But I think when they reflect and think on the options, I think people being fair-minded, I think that I don't see the government party suffering to the extent that some would predict. I think we've got a range of really good candidates, both in the locals and certainly in the Europeans as well. And we would hope in the European elections certainly to take 5 seats. And in the locals, well, it's difficult to predict given that the whole system has changed now and the number of seats has changed too.
Minister, just before we let you go, I want to ask you about rehab and the appearance before the Public Accounts Committee on Thursday. Do you think there's an element of witch hunt here? Because the HSE and other government departments give money to these organisations. They essentially buy a service from them. And we saw that up until now, certainly, the oversight wasn't the greatest. We weren't very good at auditing or asking even how that money was spent. And now we're demanding all sorts of information from them about salaries and bonuses, where we didn't really seem to care up to now.
A very good point. And I'd made the point as a Minister for Health that deals with the health services that, you know, the longer I'm in it and the more layers I peel off it, the more trouble I find. And I'm going to keep doing that till I get to the very core of it and have it fixed so that everybody can feel that their money is being used for the purposes that they gave it, whether it be the taxpayer or the ordinary citizen giving out of the goodness and kindness of their heart, which Irish people are renowned for, that is their generosity. So I would say to you, in relation to the Section 38s, that investigation arose out of the findings of the HICWA report into Talla. The HSE have followed a very careful process, and now they've got to the point, I'm happy to say, where everybody is either compliant in terms of the public pay policy or has put a business case together to become compliant by the end of this month, and I welcome that. But then we turn to the Section 39s, which are a different kettle of fish, because they receive monies from us, but they're also charitable status. You take a situation like rehab, to mention but one. I mean, tens of millions going in there from the government, and they have commercial wink to their arm as well. I personally believe that, you know, these bodies that get anything more than $250,000 should be open about the pay they pay their top executives. And I also believe that perhaps we should look into the future about separating out charities from commercial organisations, unless the commercial organisation is subject to the charity and makes money for the charity.
Angela Curran says her salary isn't paid out of the charity arm of rehab, and that it certainly doesn't come from fundraised money.
No, and that may be the case. And I mean, all I asked there was that people would come up and be upfront about what they're being paid, because we're paying a huge amount of money from the taxpayer. I think 80 million or something's going in there. So between one thing and another. So we need to know how that money is spent. We need reassurances around that. And as I say, it might be better into the future if charities, if they're involved with commercial entities, that the commercial entity should be a subset of the charity rather than the other way around.
Okay. Minister, we'll let you get back to business there at the Fine Gael Ordesh. Minister James Riley, thank you for joining us on the programme. Now, we're staying with the Ordesh for another little while, because our reporter Barry Lenehan has been wandering around the RDS and taking the temperature of the delegates there. Barry, this is party conference number 3 of the season. How does it compare to the others?
Well, I suppose, Claire, if you were contrasting and comparing the three, you could say the Labour and Sinn Féin conferences were very much light meals, but this Fine Gael Ardèche, a full dinner. It's bigger, 3,000 delegates expected here between today and yesterday in a larger venue, the RDS. Although it has to be said that the hall here last night, Claire, was little over half full during the Taoiseach's speech. There's also probably more substance in what's being discussed here. At Labour's conference, Eamon Gilmore opened with a speech full of broad brushstrokes and sweeping rhetoric on Labour's apparent achievements in office. But last night, around two-thirds of the Taoiseach speech was dedicated to matters of health and Fine Gael's plans, as we were hearing from Minister Riley, for universal health insurance. While after the Taoiseach's address, all of last night's lengthy discussion was dedicated to universal health insurance, the health system, and an interesting enough motion calling for the government to ban the sale of cigarettes in pubs and off licences. So that narrower focus, Clare, and in turn more substantive discussion, I would say, is probably the major thing that's different or unique about this Ardesh compared to those of Sinn Féin or Labour.
And Barry, is Fine Gael focusing on the local and European elections just as much as the other parties, would you say?
I suppose yes and no, Claire, really, in a sense. I mean, the lengthy discussion on universal health insurance was very much a case of instilling the foot soldiers with the information they're going to need to bat away the likely opposition attacks and questions on the doorsteps about the potential cost to families of the universal health insurance. Now, I know my more esteemed colleague David Davenport described this as a glorified election rally on the television news last night, but I'd say the focus on those local and European elections is much more nuanced here than it was at the other party conferences. Take, for example, the televised segment of the Ardesh this morning. Sinn Féin and Labour, they squeezed as many local election hopefuls as they could into that segment, whereas this morning Fine Gael wheeled out the heavy hitters, including ministers Noonan, Bruton and Coveney, and blended them with a light enough diet of local election hopefuls. Now, that televised segment focused exclusively, Clare, on jobs and economic recovery, areas where Fine Gael would argue it's done well in government. And even in the last half hour or so, there was also a promise from the finance minister Michael Noonan to cut taxes after the next budget. Now, all of this would probably suggest, Clare, that Fine Gael is very much trying to fight these forthcoming elections on national issues, probably in juxtaposition to Labour, and probably in an attempt also to transfer its healthy rating in recent opinion polls, which I'm sure Brian will mention in a few moments, to the ballot boxes itself.
Indeed, we'll be talking to Brian Dowling from RT's political staff in just a moment. What's happening for the remainder of the Ardesh there, Barry?
Well, this afternoon, Clare, the party will debate whether the government should legalise cannabis, while the party will also vote on what stance it'll take in the forthcoming referendum on same-sex marriage. Now, Justice Minister Alan Shatter is due to deliver a speech around 3 o'clock this afternoon. I suppose the eye of the political storm, really, Clare, that he's been caught up in over the last few weeks has now somewhat passed. But with Minister Shatter's department still the subject of three separate external investigations, the reception he receives this afternoon should be very interesting indeed. And in anticipation of that, I asked delegates here at the RDS how they'll welcome Minister Shatter this afternoon and why.
A very warm reception, definitely. The issue of the whistleblower, I think, has been handled quite well by the minister. I would have full faith in Minister Shatter. He's certainly a class minister.
I think he'll get a roaring reception as usual. I don't think people are angry with him. You know, there's nothing proved yet.
There'll always be controversies in health. There'll always be controversies in law. They come up all the time. There wasn't anything in it anyway. When you look at the allegations, the minister got the stuff. He wasn't hanging on to it for 2 years. He went out and he did his job.
I think Minister Shatter will get a warm reception. Fine Gael members all feel that he's doing a really good job. He's a very reforming minister. I think the last couple of weeks have been difficult, and hopefully the reviews that are being undertaken at the moment will actually clarify any misunderstandings that have happened.
Now, later this evening, Clare, the Taoiseach will deliver the traditional party leader's address, and I'm sure Andy Kenny will be very careful as he takes to the stage tonight, as he almost tripped up and fell twice on his way to the Speaker's podium last night, and obviously a bit rattled, he then made a mess of his opening quip. But for those wishing to see whether the Taoiseach can keep his footing, and indeed what message he has for the electorate, his address will be broadcast live on this station and on RT1 television at 8:30 this evening.
Barry Lennon, thank you very much indeed. Sabotaged by the opposition. We'll be talking to Billy Kelleher from Fianna Fáil a little bit later on. We'll ask him whether he had any hand in laying the carpet there at the Fine Gael Ardesh. But we're staying with that now. Brian Dowling is with us from RTE's political staff, as promised. Brian, we talked about Fine Gael's chances with Minister James Riley in the upcoming elections. How are Fine Gael going into the midterms?
They are in reasonably good health going into the midterms, it has to be said, Claire. But I think realistically the party knows they are going to lose some seats, certainly in the local elections. You have to look back to, again, 2009, the last local and European elections. In the local elections, the party came in at just under 35%. Not very far off the general election result in 2011. They had a terrific local elections back then. They actually gained 88 seats, came in with over 550-odd councillors. Now, there's obviously a much smaller pool of councils and councillors because of the remapping of local government. That said, if you look at the polling trends for the last couple of months, Fine Gael tends to be somewhere in the mid-20s, high 20s. One or two polls put them near 30. I think in an election campaign, if they can hold their own by and large, they will consider that a good result, as would any party in a midterm election when they're in government. So I think this is as much about keeping it steady, holding their own, and that nothing happens that would unnerve the party.
And what's the buzz around there, Brian? What's the main topic of conversation among Fine Gaelers this weekend?
I think earlier in the morning, Claire, it was relatively quiet around here. It's beginning to pick up at the moment. There's no escaping that there's a mood here that in the last couple of months, the figures coming in on the economic front are improving. The jobs figures particularly are really good of late. If you look in terms of the government's macroeconomic position, pretty much everything is coming in on or ahead of target. So in terms of the government's capacity to manage, sustain its budgetary plan, it looks pretty much on course at the moment. At this stage, you'd have to say perhaps the only thing that might cause a problem might be some events outside of their control, some international events that could perhaps maybe create difficulties. But if everything keeps going as it is, well then on the economic front, the party would be hoping, and their colleagues in government, Labour, would be hoping that they become the beneficiaries of what all politicians want at this kind of halfway point heading to a general election, which is where the political cycle and the economic cycles, if you like, dovetail in benign circumstances, and you can cash in on that in electoral terms come a general election particularly.
Now, I want to ask you about something in relation to the European elections, which struck many as a little strange this week. The announcement was made that Simon Harris TD is running in Ireland South. Why? I mean, surely that's the wrong constituency for him. And wasn't the former IFA president John Bryan supposed to be the man for that job?
My understanding, Claire, is that John Bryan did have an interest and did begin to tip his toes, if you like, into the water, began to talk to a number of councillors. And I think there might be a number of factors. Anybody who steps onto this stage in a European election, and particularly in the forthcoming European elections, we're talking now three constituencies instead of four, and particularly South is a big geographical area. There's a big consideration here, which is money. It costs a lot of money to run a European election campaign. There's no doubt about that. The other question then is, while John Bryan had a national profile through his work with farmers in the IFA, in the last couple of months, I think it has to be said that Simon Harris has also had a pretty good profile, particularly through some of his work in some of the committees in the Dáil. And I think the consideration might be, if you look, the sitting MEP, John Kelly from Kerry. In Cork, they have Deirdre Clune. Again, a well-established base. Fine Gael wants to win two of the seats in South, and by having Simon Harris in the field, it does give them a chance to allow him to try to consolidate the Fine Gael vote, if you like, in the Wexford, Wicklow, coming down into Carlow, Kilkenny, into that territory. Deirdre Clune, if she is to be the person best positioned to take the second seat, she needs to have something of the magnitude of 70,000 first preference votes. That's a big ask. So I think in terms of electoral strategy and positioning, maybe the party strategist felt that putting Simon Harris in at that end of the constituency offers the best chance of either him or Deirdre Clune taking a second seat.
All right, we'll leave it there. Brian, thanks very much for joining us today. That's Brian Dowling there from RTE's political staff joining us from the Fine Gael